Hey, podcast listeners. It's 2019, and, well, there's a lot going on in the world. Trade wars, street protests, multiple ongoing refugee crises. It can be hard to get past the noise and understand it all. That's why I turn again and again to the podcast Global Dispatches. The host, Mark Leon Goldberg, he has some smart conversations with some of the most well-informed experts in the foreign policy world, from leaders like former New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark to on-the-ground activists in countries from Sudan to Myanmar. I know if you're a fan of First Person, you'll enjoy Global Dispatches. From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, Vladimir Putin, Russia's ruler for life. Vladimir Putin called for changes to the Russian constitution last week that could potentially allow him to continue ruling the country even after his presidential term runs out in 2024. After his proposal, the entire Russian cabinet resigned, allowing Putin to appoint a relatively unknown technocrat to serve as prime minister.
Mikhail Mishustin was head of the country's federal tax service. He was put forward as Putin's choice for prime minister after Dmitry Medvedev and his entire government resigned on Wednesday.
Putin, a former KGB spy, has ruled the country for more than two decades, as either president or prime minister. The Russian constitution bars him from seeking another presidential term, but the changes he's proposing would weaken the presidency, allowing him to serve in some other position and still retain control.
Vladimir Putin had his State of the Union address today, where he called for some changes to Russia's constitution to give actually the parliament more power and less power to the presidency, which some people see as Vladimir Putin preparing for 2024 when his term runs out and when normally he would have to leave power.
Putin remains popular in Russia, but his approval rating has fallen in recent years, in part over the country's economic problems. On our show this week, we hear from Masha Gessen, a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the book The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Gessen received a National Book Award in 2017 for another one of her books, The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Masha, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I'm curious, when did you first become aware of Vladimir Putin?
So in 1998, a close friend of mine who was a member of parliament was killed in her apartment stairway in St. Petersburg. And so I went to St. Petersburg to write about the murder. I was a journalist, a Russian language journalist for sort of the biggest news weekly. And I ended up spending a couple of years writing about St. Petersburg politics, which I found to be strikingly different from Moscow politics, or politics as we knew politics in Russia at the time. St. Petersburg was a place where journalists told me that they were being followed, or their offices and apartments were bugged, where political assassinations happened literally in the middle of an afternoon, in the middle of the central street in the city. So St. Petersburg was kind of a preview of what Russia was going to become. And Vladimir Putin, at that point, he had served as the deputy governor. And he was very much the architect of politics, St. Petersburg style, which, again, is strikingly similar to Putinism as we came to know it. But I didn't learn his actual name until he became head of the FSB, the secret police, in 1999.
In your book, The Man Without a Face, you describe how Vladimir Putin was sort of a product of the brutality that St. Petersburg, or Leningrad, as it was known during the Second World War, had experienced. Can you just give us a moment on what that was?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that he was a product, right? I think that this is, I mean, as writers of some kind of history, we always have this bias toward making things look determined. Certainly all kinds of people grew up in St. Petersburg right after the war, including, you know, my friend who was assassinated, who wasn't like Vladimir Putin. But I thought it was important to, in the book, to kind of give a picture of the really devastated and devastating place. So he was born in 1952 7 years after the end of World War II. And Leningrad at the time was still, it was still basically in ruins. These were the ruins, the memories left by the 900-day siege of Leningrad. That is one of the most catastrophic events in war history. German troops laid siege to St. Petersburg for nearly 3 years. The city was cut off from virtually all food supplies and any other kinds of supplies. People used their furniture and then their window frames for heating their apartments. They ate anything they could get their hands on, including other people. At least 1 million people died of starvation in the city during that time. We still don't have accurate figures. So people who lived in Leningrad during the war, they saw the death and devastation.
Right? And Putin's own parents, I mean, as you describe in the book, his mother had lost two children, one in infancy before the war, and then one who was put into a children's home. And they both were physically debilitated, although they survived the war as a couple, which was somewhat unusual.
It was both a tragedy and a miracle. Putin's mother nearly died of starvation during the siege, and his older brother, whom he obviously never saw, died during of starvation during the siege. His father was wounded as a soldier just outside of Leningrad, then came back to Leningrad and found his wife, who was about to starve to death. And somehow they sort of managed to save each other and survive as a couple, but as a very, very damaged couple of people. And Putin was this miracle child born to people in their 40s who were disabled in 1952 at a time when there was still great shortage of everything. There was great physical damage to their environment. And when people didn't have children, so he was one of a very few children sort of roaming this damaged city.
So you hadn't heard much about him, but you'd heard about the style of politics that came to be known now as what, I guess, Putin-style politics. But when did you first write about him?
I've been writing about Putin for 20 years. So he was appointed prime minister of Russia by the ailing president Boris Yeltsin in August 1999. Right? Boris Yeltsin was nearing the end of his second term as president. He was a very ill, very hard drinking, and very isolated man at that point. He had grown to surround himself with a tiny group of people and was really scared that after he left office, he would be prosecuted for things that had happened in the 1990s, and there was ample reason to do that. So he needed to find somebody whom he could anoint successor, who would not be part of the opposition, and who would grant him immunity from prosecution. And there weren't a lot of people to choose from, because most of the people that he had worked with in earlier, braver, brighter times had gone over to the opposition. So he was looking basically at the possibility of one nameless, faceless bureaucrat or another. And one of his close confidants, the oligarch Boris Berezovsky, suggested Putin, who was at the time a very young, unknown head of the secret police. He had not risen through the ranks in the secret police. He was sort of brought in laterally. He had served up until the early 90s, but he had left in the rank of lieutenant colonel, and suddenly he was brought in to run the secret police. So then they pluck him out of there and make him prime minister. And the idea was very much that he was inexperienced, uncharismatic, controllable. He was going to grant Yeltsin immunity from prosecution, and the family, Yeltsin's inner circle, would essentially continue to run the country. So, at that point, Russia had the makings of a mafia state in that sense, but it had a lot of democratic mechanisms that were actually sort of, that had taken on a life of their own and were developing. There was a flawed but functioning electoral system. There was a robust media scene, and there was a kind of public politics. And then Putin comes, and the first thing that he wants to do is get rid of the family, because he wants to actually take control. So he got rid of the family. He did grant Yeltsin immunity from prosecution. He dismantled the electoral institutions, and he took over the media. And we kind of know the rest.
It's fascinating to me that Putin was just a complete unknown, a sort of blank slate. What did people know about him?
People knew that he had been a career KGB officer up until an unknown point, because he then, when his biography was being manufactured, claimed to have resigned from the KGB in August 1991. I think he was lying. But at some point, he parted ways with the KGB, or maybe he didn't. Maybe he remained sort of in active reserve until he became head of the secret police. That's pretty much the sum total of facts that were known about Putin when he became prime minister. And then when he was acting president and presidential candidate, that's when a sort of Putin story had to be created. And there were a couple of Putin stories created on parallel tracks. There was the Putin story that Putin himself dictated to his biographers. And there's the Putin story that was created for kind of public consumption by political consultants. The Putin story for public consumption was that he was young, educated, well-traveled. He had served as a KGB agent in Dresden, Germany. European, healthy, and unembarrassing. Yeltsin had been, he had made people ashamed to watch television, right? Because he would get drunk and not come out of his plane because he had fallen asleep when he had landed in Ireland to meet with the Prime Minister of Ireland, or have to be held up at an official function because he was falling down drunk. And the idea that we could have a president who was young and wore European cut suits and spoke languages and didn't drink just seemed like that was the promise of becoming like a normal Western country. Putin himself was dictating a very different story. He was talking about his personal mythology as a thug. Basically, the story he tells about himself is a story of getting into fights. As a child, as a university student, as a young KGB agent in training to become a spy. And at every point, it's basically the same story. He gets really upset, gets into a fight, then goes back into his corner, allows his opponent to think that the fight is over, and then lunges again. So it's like the story of somebody who is aggressive, vengeful, and treacherous. And that's what he wants people to know about him. But I think Russians were so desperate to feel like we had a normal president that people projected all sorts of things onto him. That kind of blank slate that was created by the political consultants, for some people became this idea that he was actually going to be an economic reformer, a Democrat, you know, he was really going to take Russia into the future. And for other people, it became the promise of going back to the past, you know, to a time that was more predictable, more stable, somehow felt better to them. So when I first wrote about him in January 2000, I was looking at the decrees he signed when he first became acting president. And the decrees he signed actually told volumes. Like his first decree was granting Yeltsin immunity from prosecution, but his second decree said that we should re-establish primary military training in high schools, which was such an integral part of sort of the Russian military culture, but also the Soviet us against the world culture, the Soviet imperialist identity. And I thought, you know, what kind of person would sign as that as their second decree, right? My guess was that he was somebody who was going to traffic in Soviet nostalgia and somebody who was going to try to reestablish Russia as a great military power and really remilitarize both the culture and the economy. That was a pretty damn good guess in January 2000.
So you mentioned that the sense was when he was plucked that he'd be controllable or pliable, and it seems as though immediately that's sort of proven false. And, you know, you describe at various points I've seen you and read over the years that, you know, there's a sort of return to gradual authoritarianism in Russia. But his first weeks in office and first months don't feel gradual at all. There's actually quite a number of things that change.
On his first day in office, two things happen. He proposes a package of legislation that would reform Russia's federal structure. So greatly weaken the governorships, among other things, giving the president the right to fire governors, elected governors, and also making the upper house of parliament no longer an elected body. The Russian constitution, which was very hastily drafted in 1993, had some mushy language, some unclear language, and he apparently had lawyers who were very good at reading the constitution and found the mushy places. So one mushy place was the provision for the upper house of parliament. It wasn't clear whether it was supposed to be elected or constituted in some other way. So there had been direct elections to the upper house of parliament up until 2000, but Putin proposed reform that didn't involve changing the constitution that would make them appointed, not elected. And the other thing that happened on that very same day was a raid on the offices of Media Most, the large independent media company that had been highly critical of Putin as he was running for election, and that had run some very important investigative pieces on its television network. And so masked men with machine guns showed up at the offices of Media Most. I think they were claiming to be carrying out a tax warrant or something. I don't know. But in any case, it was a very clear warning shot.
And Media Most was your employer at the time, wasn't it?
Media Most was my employer. I wasn't. I didn't work in the corporate building, so I wasn't there. It owned a number of media outlets, the most important of which was a federal, a nationwide television channel, which is really the reason that Putin went after them. I worked for the Newsweekly, which in terms of sort of reach and impact was nowhere near the impact of the television channel. So in a way, we're kind of an accidental victim. They probably wouldn't have gone after us if we hadn't been part of the same holding.
Did you
but
see
as
the raid?
It was,
oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, as it was, it took Putin a little bit less than a year. But in April 2001, the entire staff of the magazine where I worked came to work to find that we were locked out, and there was a new staff in the building making a magazine.
Ever wonder what it's like to fly around the world with John McCain? How about traveling to Iowa with Xi Jinping? I'm Ilan Goldenberg, host of Stories from the Back Channel, a podcast from the Center for a New American Security. In our second season, we continue to explore what national security professionals do and why they matter.
Some days I would leave the building just thinking, man, we've made some choices that are going to make the country safer, and that is really thrilling.
It's Stories from the Back Channel, Season 2, coming soon.
I'm curious about when you yourself began to feel under scrutiny as a member of the press.
Oh, well, for me, it was super fast. I was probably one of the first. So it happened that because I had been reporting on St. Petersburg for 2 years in the late 90s, I was aware of all these things that were happening there, including this one really bizarre case of a media executive who had been jailed on charges that I couldn't make any sense of. I couldn't understand why he was in jail, like who had something against him. And so I had accumulated all these documents on this particular case, but I'd never written about it. And then in June 2000, the owner of the media holding where I worked, Vladimir Gusinsky, got arrested. And he got arrested in connection with this St. Petersburg case. I mean, that was the official pretext for the arrest. Because his media holding actually had a stake in the other guy's media company, the guy who was jailed. And so for a pretext for arresting Gusinsky so that then he could be intimidated into signing over his media holding to the state, which is what happened, they used the pretext of that case. So, wow, suddenly it all made sense to me. I pulled up all these documents and I wrote a long investigative piece on the case, and it was published in my magazine. And by the time the piece came out in print, Gusinsky had already left the country. And I was being really, you know, severely intimidated. Basically, there was a guy who was parked 24 hours a day in front of my apartment door. So it's like the small apartment building in Moscow. I lived on the second floor, second of four floors. And there were only two apartments on the landing. And every time I opened the door, there was a guy on a ladder. I mean, I think they probably took turns. But every time I opened the door, there was a guy on a ladder sort of pretending to be looking at the electrical thingy, you know, in the wall. And I'd say, you know, what are you doing here? And he'd say, I'm fixing things. My landline was cut off. The lawyers for MediaMost told me that I should expect to have my apartment searched. And they told me that they wouldn't be able to protect me or give me legal representation, which was lovely. And then the prosecutor in the case called me before the piece came out and said, do not publish a piece about this or you'll be sorry. Do not get into this or you'll be sorry. And, you know, these were like really naive times for Russian journalists. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to publish the fact that he threatened me, which I did. And like that was going to protect me. It was really, really terrifying. So I ended up leaving the country for a few weeks. And then I came back. It had kind of sort of calmed down. But I also decided that I would leave my job at the Russian magazine and go. I went to U.S. News and World Report and became the bureau chief for U.S. News and World Report. Starting that fall. And I also became the first accredited foreign correspondent, because that was now my status, to be blacklisted by the Kremlin. So I was, you know, I was a bureau chief, but I couldn't attend any of the press conferences or, you know, any of the meetings with foreign journalists, which again, like a few years later, that became just kind of normal.
Masha, I want you to actually explain to us what happened this past week, the constitutional changes that he proposed. You wrote in the New Yorker this past week that it was the beginning of a long and tedious process designed to ensure that Russia stays more or less exactly the same for as long as Putin shall live. What did you mean by that?
A couple of things I think are important to understand about Putin. In 2012-2013, there was a really severe political crackdown that was a reaction to what Putin perceived as a threat to his power, which was mass protests all over the country that broke out in the winter of 2011-2012. And that crackdown is ongoing. Russia today is very, very different even from the Russia that I left in 2013. It no longer has any independent media. It no longer has any possibility of collective action. Right. Even though we see protests there, but I would argue that they're not collective action in any meaningful way. There's no organizing that's possible. Sometimes somebody will put out a call for people to come and protest, and some very brave individuals, sometimes by the thousands, come and protest. But there's no organizing involved. There's no acting with others. It's individual action. You go out, you go back home afterward, and you're back sort of to your online world. So the possibility of any kind of politics is really, you know, it's just been scorched. And so in this context, Putin is still 4 years away from the end of his currently legal last term as president. Right? And in this context, he's putting in motion a very slow-moving mechanism that is designed to ensure that he will not even have to face the possibility of challenge, right? And I'm talking about it in such a convoluted way because I think that normal language that we use to describe political processes is always based on assumptions that don't apply to Russia, right? Like people have tried to say, maybe, you know, it's a coup. Well, it's a coup if you can perpetrate a coup against yourself. Putin is the only person with power in Russia, and, you know, he's staging a coup against, you know, it breaks down. It's constitutional reform. Even that is misleading because it suggests that the constitution has weight, that there's, you know, maybe a judiciary that can make independent decisions or anything, right? So also people say consolidation of power, which is like the most difficult one to sort of say, no, that's wrong. I mean, you can't consolidate power any further. It would be a miracle of physics. It's already consolidated fully, right? So what is happening? He's paranoid. He sees the possibility of a challenge to his power where none exists. This is not without precedent in the history of dictators. And in fact, that's what makes dictators most stable, right? Dictators fall when they become overconfident, when they think that they're truly so beloved by the population that they will, for example, call an election, like Milosevic did. And bingo, he falls. Putin is not like that. Putin is paranoid, like, for example, Stalin, right? Who kept sending people to jail to death for what was in his imagination, the possibility of a challenge to his legitimacy, when in fact there was none. And Stalin stayed in power until he died and, you know, ruled Russia, ruled the Soviet Union for 30 years. Putin is that style of paranoid. What he's protecting himself against doesn't actually exist. And let me just explain the process, yes? So he has, he gave this very strange, very muddy speech. And, you know, most of his speeches are very muddy because they can be interpreted in any way possible. That's part of the way that sort of reality is made mushy under Putin. But he has created a 75-person commission to propose reforms to the Constitution, which will then be brought to a popular vote, but as a package, right? So it's going to be kind of a, you know, yes, we're for Putin and his reforms, or no, we're against Putin and his reforms. So we know what the outcome of that vote is going to be. People are not actually going to be able to vote on substantively. But the 75-person commission consists in part of legislators and jurists, which is what you would expect, but it also includes theater directors, film directors, the heads of the two most important museums in Russia, the heads of two medical clinics, the heads of some charities. So what these people have in common is that they're very well known and much loved, and their work depends entirely on Putin's goodwill and presidential funding. And so it falls to these people to say, please, we want to change the Constitution to allow you to stay in office for life, and also to live forever if possible.
Masha, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Masha Gessen. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with help from Dan Haverty. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you like this episode, hit subscribe on your podcast app. And then come back next week. We'll have a new episode. Thanks for listening.